This episode of Go Bag, we touch on a website that every handler in Delta Green should be aware of, a series on Netflix that we enjoy.
We have an incoming encrypted transmission.
That's right. It's an encrypted comms Q&A with grenades thrown from Laramie Wall, Dan, a.k.a. Dependable Skeleton, Spez Baby, Digital Hobbit, and Runeslinger. Hit it.
Strap in, operatives. This is Go Bag, your all-access pass to modern-day RPGs, loaded with bullets, backstories, and a whole lot of bad decisions. And here are your mission leaders, Sean and Harrigan.
Welcome, everybody, to Go Bag. I'm your host, Sean, and joining me is my counterpart, Harrigan. How you doing, Harrigan?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Good.
You want to get right into what we've been up to?
You
want to start?
Yeah.
Go for it, man.
All right. So I have been, as far as covert action goes, my Delta Green game seems to be at the forefront of that side of my life, if you will. We wrapped up Convergence, for those that know Delta Green. I've kind of narrated the end. I think I said that in the last episode of Go Bag on how I wrapped it up with like a 45-minute dialogue of how everybody turned out and it was finished. Then the question was, what am I going to run next for them in the Delta Green world? I, for whatever reason...
You chose the difficult path.
I went impossible landscapes.
You did.
I think it's great. I like running it. I like the premise. I don't feel as though I am an expert, even though this is my second go, because it's such a beast.
Well, back up a second, because I don't know if every listener will know what Impossible Landscapes even is.
True.
What is it, Sean? What's the thumbnail of what that
is? It is the first full-length campaign published by Arc Dream Publishing, the makers of Delta Green the Game. So there are lots of modules out there. There are lots of compilations, right? You could get Black Sites, and it has five modules or five scenarios that they had previously as solo, consolidated into one. Many are not connected. They're just, we'll put these five in a book and release the book as a hardback. But Impossible Landscapes is the first full-length campaign for
Delta. It's like a 300-page plus big-ass campaign that spans decades, right?
It does. And it is centered around, without any spoilers, I guess it, I don't know if it's a spoiler necessarily, but it is more around the King in Yellow than it is Lovecraftian in nature.
Yep.
So those are two different things.
Right. But point being, it is a big, meaty piece of work that will take a playing group a long time to get through. It's chunky.
Beefy.
Someone even say chonky.
Like my cats.
Yeah. Chonky. There's a lot to it. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is because, Sean, I think on the show and privately, you have said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this Delta Green group next. I don't know if they want to keep playing. I'm not sure how into it some of them are. Some of them are really into it. So I got to figure out what the next step is. So apparently I'll just play the big one. We'll roll out the big guns.
So Night Floors, I think, is a pretty good scenario. And Night Floors is the first chapter of Impossible Landscapes. And it was actually done by Dennis Detwiller as a single scenario. It was never a long, it's kind of like...
I didn't know that. It was meant to be self-contained.
It was, yep. Okay. And it's kind of like Masks of Nyarlathotep, right? They have a precursor now to the modern day one.
Oh yeah, there's an opening that happens way before in the timeline than the main events of the module.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And so it's similar to how they kind of incorporated that, I think, into Impossible Landscapes. So anyways, I kick that off. And the thing is, we started off with like going through the section of the book of the home scenes and how to like boost the bond, boost your sanity, boost the skill at the risk of nailing down a bond. So we went through some of those things. I talked to Jeff about having incendiary grenades in his go bag and things of that nature. like you can, anything you can buy in a local big major retailer, I'm all for. Those other things, not so sure. We got to talk about those.
You know what you could do? You could take kind of a modern OSR mindset and say, for the really special stuff, you have to quest for it. So if your character wants those incendiary grenades or that plastique or whatever, how do you propose you're going to get it? And you could actually play it out a little bit. Have them meet some unsavory characters, have some things potentially go wrong, right? You could do that.
Right. I can. I could. So he kind of came to, I would say, to his senses and said, you know, okay, I'll erase those. Not a big deal. You know, but he has his go bag. And I did propose, if you're going to travel and you got to get there next day and you're 1,000 miles away, you are simply not going to make it if you drive.
You're going to fly. Yeah. Which means the go bag has to go through security.
Right.
Yeah.
So you guys take that for what it's worth. So we'll see. I think I could get through night floors and then determine whether to sprinkle in a bunch of other stuff before going further.
And having played, but on the player side of night floors with you, that scenario can F you up pretty good all on its own.
Yes, it can.
You know? Yep.
Yeah. I'm trying to study impossible landscapes. And when I've read certain forum posts, they're like, I would never run that because it's this format and that I wouldn't be keen on necessarily. And so I am conscious of that a little bit more.
What do you mean by format? What do you mean by that?
Well, certain things that the characters will encounter that could frustrate the characters.
Oh, yes. It is not a game that focuses on the players having agency and knowing what the hell's going on. Yeah. Yes.
So,
yes. Spoilers. Now I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't want to drive my players like to the brink of like, this is pissing me off as a player. Like,
it's a fine line.
Yes.
So there's a lot of that in that campaign.
There is. And that's why a lot of people have complained. So we'll see how it goes. I'm still jazzed. I don't know if that's going to be the be all end all. It'll be interesting regardless. So, and then maybe I'll pivot. Jeff and his spouse, I helped him out a little bit over the holidays to let their dogs out, and they realized it was my birthday at the time. And so they bought me a little birthday present, which is God's Hunt.
The new hardcover from Arc Dream.
Yes.
Which is, like you were saying before, a compilation or a collection of potentially related but not really related modules, right?
Correct.
That are operas, I should say.
I think they touch on the God's Teeth main thing that I have not digested completely. A lot of people have been like, I would run God's Teeth over Impossible Landscapes, but...
Really? Even though the content in that is well-known to be very problematic.
I heard.
In terms of, like, lines and veils and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
For those of us who are old pieces of leather and that stuff doesn't bother, it's great. It's not great for everybody.
Right.
Right.
So anyways, that is the Delta Green saga of Sean. We played Top Secret last week with Jason. So whether that drops prior to this episode or later, Jason Connerly of Nerds RPG Variety Podcast ran that for us.
Yes. Thank you so much, Jason. Like it was great to have somebody who knew the rules better than either you or I did, kind of, just at a cold read, your experience having been decades ago. It was really cool to have somebody who had it at their fingertips, you know, around the game. It was good.
Yeah. And just so everybody's aware, Jason was not kind of pegged to do that originally. We had somebody else that was lined up, couldn't make that happen. Jason stepped in and said, hey,
he filled in last minute
for you guys. And so as much as we would, you know, as much prep as he had at the time to make that happen, you know, he stepped up and did it for us. So very much appreciated. I know that I probably wouldn't have been able to do that and pull it off.
No, he did a great job. And we had, you know, we try to keep the vignettes reasonably short, between 1 and 2 hours, I think, is what we're, maybe around 2 hours, what we're probably going to aim for. And we went a little bit long with Jason, but he took up like a full, I think, convention style module, 4 hour length, condensed it down. We had fun. It was good. It was good. We may break down some of the, like, what we learned about what we still do and don't like about that system in a future episode. We're not going to get into that right now, right?
Well, and even to more credit to Jason, like, we weren't the most enthusiastic about the game.
That's not true. I definitely wanted to play it.
Yes, we wanted to play it. But if somebody were to listen to our show and then go, you know, I could run it for them and prove them, you know, that it is a decent game, sure. But there's also the, well, I'm not running for those two jokers because they.
Yes, I'm because they're critical of it.
Because every time I bring up something, they're just going to laugh and have a good chuckle. And
I think we were pretty respectful in that
regard. I would say we were, absolutely.
I played the game that was in front of me, man. It's a mantra of mine. Like, play the game that's on the table. Use the rules that are there if you can, unless you got house rules. And he, at the end of that, I remember him saying, Harrigan, I probably didn't change your mind, did I? And I'm like, nope, not at all. But I still had fun, you know? So, you know, we'll get it. We'll break that down maybe a little bit later when the vignettes start dropping for fans. Sean's been hard at work. He does all the work on this stuff, adding some kind of special features to at least the James Bond one so far, which means it takes a little bit longer to edit. So I think we should see one of those soon, though, with Bond one dropping soon.
James Bond is edited. So we recorded the video, and what I wanted to do was Harrigan references some rules and charts, and then what's my score on my character sheet. And I actually take screenshots of what he's actually referencing. So if it's wrong, I could just go, like, I could put it, edit over the text and go, I don't know what he's talking about here, right?
Ooh, there's probably a lot of those.
Well, no, it's surprisingly, I was like, it's almost funny when you're explaining it, it's like literally like says it right across the page in text. So I've taken screenshots of those and I've put them in where the video is like bringing down the row, highlighting the row, here's the number that we're coming up with and how. And taking out some of like, well, hold on a second, I got to look this up, right? Taking that out, crunching it a little bit. And so when I do the audio, I'm extracting that, but I would also want to put in those physical images. And I could do that in a podcast. I could actually put them in as chapter markers without actually having it be a chapter. I could just have the image
show up. Oh, like an image comes up, right.
At a specific timestamp.
Again, though, that's a lot of editing.
It creates a little overhead, but I just have to make note of where those would appear and put them in appropriately. And it's tedious, but not.
Well, thank you for doing that. I think I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen the first one yet. And we have Top Secret in the can, as Sean is suggesting. So we have the ability to do another one or just release it more like just a regular podcast, right? Like it'll be 2.5 hours long, I think. Yeah, that was really fun. Thank you again, Jason.
Yes, thanks, Jason. We'll be tapping you for future episodes, by the way. Actual place. Don't know Agent Provocateur? That's all right. We'll give you a few minutes. I'll send you a book.
I also am running Delta Green, but it's play by post over on Gamers Plane, and it's a solo operation. So one player, one GM. I'm the GM. And I think I've talked on this show and other places a lot about how I like the smaller scope Delta Green stuff. And I'm doing that finally. I'm focusing on shotgun scenarios that are from the Fairfield project from that website, which I think we've linked to before, Sean. If we haven't, maybe we can drop that in the show notes. I'm sure you have already.
I don't know if we've actually linked to the Fairfield project. I don't think we have.
Maybe we should.
We will in this episode down below.
Okay.
Check it out. Yeah.
So one of the Fairfield project is a fan community that has deep connections back to the current publishers of Delta Green Arc Dream, to the tune of when they run a contest, the Arc Dream guys will actually award product to the people who win the contest at the Fairfield Project. And many, many of the adventures that have now been published by Arc Dream started off as shotgun scenarios, including Last Things Last, the relatively famous starter one with, you know, that comes in the free quick start, right?
I did not know that.
That is from the first year of the shotgun scenarios. So what a shotgun scenario is, for those who don't know, I think we may have touched on this already, so apologies if we have. These are short and sharp 1,500-word essays, adventure outlines, module, or what are called operations or operas in the Delta Green landscape. These are short operas that introduce, like, what's going on, who are the players, What's the timeline of what happens if the players do or don't do these things? But over 1,500 words, you're only getting a few pages worth of text down. they've collected hundreds of these by now by having an annual contest that runs through December 15th of this year. So by our date right now, Sean, it's the 30th of November. People have about 2 weeks to get these in. I've got two ideas. I'm hoping to submit one of them, but I got to find the time to write them up. So anyway, long story short, I love these little sort of slice. They're shorter, they're sharper, they're, you know, I'll put it this way. I struggle with running adventures like Masks of Nyarlathotep and all the Pathfinder adventure path stuff just isn't for me, even though I'm not a Pathfinder guy. I can tell the books are just too big. The big 5e adventures and even Impossible Landscapes. Like, I don't love the, man, I gotta consume all this, keep it in my headspace, remember which character comes in when, and like all that stuff, which can be brilliant. But I just, as a preference, I like leaner stuff that I add to and make it more organically my own. So, for example, for people who are fans of Rob Schwalb's adventures for both Shadow of a Demon Lord and his newer game, I think it's Shadow of the Weird Wizard, those adventures tend to be between like 4 and 6 pages. And there's like really good ideas in them that you can easily build on. And the shotgun scenarios strike me as exactly the same way. So I'm running one right now with this player, Dirigible, who I've mentioned on the show before. And basically I'm taking a lightweight framework and I'm building out a bunch of stuff that I think would be, you know, what else would be cool in this scene, or what else could you do with it? So it gives the person who likes to build up their adventures from a skeleton, it gives them all kinds of ways to do that. I said I was going to be short, and I lied through my teeth. So I'm also running Delta Green and loving it already. We're starting to, you know, we're in the briefing right now in the play-by-post game. It's a very short kind of thing where it's like, after the briefing, like, go to the car with your go bag and get to this place, which is 3.5 hours away, and look for this person. They're missing. They're a friendly. We want to find out what the hell's going on. And it's that simple of a setup to kind of get going. So it's pretty cool. Also still running the Covert Ops game, which has pretty decent pace at this point. The players all seem pretty interested and pretty on board with what we're doing, and they're still in Prague kind of thing. So that's been fun. I've been listening again to a couple of Restas Classified podcasts, some really cool ones around CIA agents in Moscow in the 80s and what that environment was like, because the KBG knew who the CIA case handlers were. And I'll just say this, Sean. I've only listened to the first half of these of a two-parter, but there's a situation where one of the stories the two hosts tell is a case handler who knows he's watched at every minute of his time in Moscow. Right? He starts going for a run. He adopts this like, I need to get in better shape. I need, you know, to run to clear my head kind of thing. The KGB team who watches him doesn't like that, and they start stealing his shoes so he can't go for a run.
I heard that one. I have listened to that one. Yes,
it's so good. So this happens a couple of times to him, because what they're thinking he's doing is he's going for a run to lose the tail. And he's meeting with somebody, he's doing a dead drop, he's doing something, is what they're mad about. And at one point, they steal his shoes for like the second or third time. He's in his apartment. He looks at the ceiling and says, look, I'm just trying to get in shape. I need you know, for my mental health, I need to run. This is the route I'm taking. You know, please just allow me to do this. And the next day, his shoes were returned in his apartment. So
I remember that. Like, that was
is insane.
I think that was the series where they were one of the, like, the radar tech guy.
Correct. The Russian radar engineer,
yes,
wanted to defect, and he tried, and not just defect, but just, like, give them information to take down the Soviet Union, because he hated where he lived. Yeah, without going way into it, is a fantastic. It's a two-part episode. It is pretty fantastic, frankly. And then the big thing that I did that I mentioned, I think last time, maybe 2 weeks ago now, I had a friend who recommended 3 Days of the Condor. It was like, you got to watch, you know, if you're interested in espionage these days and watching spy flicks and whatnot, check out that movie. It's an all-time classic kind of thing. Another friend of mine is like one of his favorite movies. So I'm like, all right, I've never seen this movie. I'll watch it. So I did. Have you seen this movie, Sean?
Oh, dude, it's been so long. That's Robert Redford, right?
That is Robert Redford. We're going to talk about that.
It's been a while. I know that he was going into an office and there was a lot of typewriters.
That's a great takeaway from that film. I will sum it up and simply say, you know, for those who have an interest in, certainly in old school espionage or a sort of 60s, 70s, this is like mid 70s that the movie was made, maybe even late 70s. 77 or something like that. I forget. We can go look for the show notes if you want, but it's a very entertaining watch. It is very much of its time. And for those who don't know me very well, I struggle with some of the filmmaking and directorial choices and styles that existed in the 60s and 70s sometimes. So in other words, when you get into that pre-Sopranos, pre-The Wire kind of level of direction of things, they're more play-like. So there's a lot of like, someone comes into the room, it's like, I'm going to come into the room and deliver my line. And everyone else in the room is waiting for them to say that. Very play-like. And then the other person goes, I'm glad I waited for you to speak so that we could have a clear conversation. And now it's your turn to talk. Oh, is it now? Right? There's this like kind of artificial back and forth. It's got some of that going on a little bit. So there's some of its time stuff that grates on me when I watch some older movies. Not every older movie, but some older movies just have they've just got a thing that I'm watching. And I just got kind of a frown on my face when I'm watching it. Like, this dialogue sucks. The action is frankly terrible. Like the fist fights and whatnot. Like Star Trek is better from the late 60s is better than this movie. Yes, with the two-handed Kirk axe below, which is what Sean's pantomiming right now. So there is... I'll just say I have mixed feelings about it. There is some incredibly cool gunplay stuff where they have these silenced, the assassins in the movie have these silenced MAC-10s, which are just super cool. And the place that you mentioned, which is a branch office of the CIA in New York City with all the typewriters, this is a group of people who, this is pretty funny, they're supposed to be reading, quote unquote, every book ever published. They're reading them all. I think meaning the ones that are new that are coming out onto the market, because they're looking for people communicating with each other in clandestine ways. So they're looking for codes, patterns, which is pretty cool. So there's this collection of kind of like nerds who are in the office going through all these materials. And Robert Redford's character is one of those characters. And without, you know, I guess I will warn a little bit. There's some spoilers here, but I'm not going to reveal everything. But basically, there's a hit that's put on the whole office and everyone is killed except for Redford, who is like, he slipped out the back because he has his own way of sort of doing things. And he's going to get everybody lunch. So he's just he's fortuitous in that he just isn't present when the hit happens, right? So it kind of goes on from there. But there's some really stuff that I really like. There's clearly filmed on location in New York City in the 70s, and the city looks great. Like, the city looks incredibly grimy, dirty, for those who remember or just remember pictures of the city, even if you didn't live there back in the 70s and 80s before it really got cleaned up. It has that, like, the traffic, the smog, the trash on the streets, the homeless. Like, it is kind of like a really great thumbnail of what 70s big American cities were like. So it has that going for it. There's some really weird stuff around male-female relationships, like Faye Dunaway's character. It makes some pretty strange choices in the movie, that are just, they don't seem to be written. Some of the female characters are not written all that well. It's because, I guess what I would say, again, sort of its time kind of thing, right? I will tell you this, Sean, I think you know this, you know, I'm about as hetero as they come, but Robert Redford is so hot in this movie. Yeah, I think I'd do him. Yep. dude is so hot.
1975 it came out, but I do agree with Redford looks top notch
for sure. Dude is so good looking. Yeah. It's ridiculous. And there is some pretty cool 70s spycraft in it. So at one point he's like former like communications specialist when he was in the military before he mustered out and went to work for the CIA, right? And there's a point where he wants to like intercept a phone call, and he goes to a hotel where it's being made. He patches in with a manual patch kit to the switchboard, captures some ingoing, outgoing phone calls. I'm not going to remember every detail here, but in the end, he captures the dial tone that someone uses, the beep, boop, 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 when you press the number pad. And he has a computer in 1975 that he can call at Langley. And he calls the computer because the analysts have access to it to do, you know, to track down phone numbers and that kind of thing. And he plays the tones and it tells them the number. It's really pretty cool. So he goes through this whole way of trying to find out who was called by this certain person after he called them. it's, you know, the plot is cool. I won't ruin that part. The plot is cool. It's not explained all that well until kind of the very end. So there's a lot of like, why was the hit in place? Who's after him? Is it the company? Is it the CIA who's trying to kill him? Is there a schism inside the CIA? So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So in the end, you know, it's worth watching. And if you are not bothered by some of the 70s isms and some, you know, some of the clunk that's in older movies, you'll probably like it even more than I did. But I, thumbs up, I guess, is what I would say. But I did not love it, but I liked it.
Not a surprise.
Yeah. All right. That's, I think, all I had going on. And you know what? We've taken some time here on our own personal, like, our worlds, which is okay, because what are we doing this week in terms of, like, a show topic?
We're going to field a couple of voicemails and a few write-ins. Nothing too crazy.
It's a Q&A show.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got several calls, or one call, several emails, and we knew we had some meaty stuff to talk about that we were both doing in our own, like, Delta Green and Day of the Condor kind of lives. So we'll round out the episode with some Q&A, right?
Before we do, we have sit rep.
Give me the sit rep.
So we'll put in the Fairfield project and a link to that and some of the shotgun scenarios if you're interested. If you are in the Delta Green, no, you may be already aware of many of these. It's ones that I stay away from because they're so short and I wouldn't know what I'm doing, where Harrigan loves because they're so short and he would feel like he knows what he's doing. So,
yeah, you know what? Let me tack on one thing, is that there's a quirk about the Fairfield Project site.
Yes.
The shotgun scenarios are not that easy to find. Like, there's no menu item that says shotgun scenarios. You have to look in one, and there's like three different menus on the site. It's kind of old school, not in a good way necessarily. But once you find them, there's something to the effect of like, I think it's like scenarios. And of the scenarios, it lists a bunch of Arc Dream stuff, some longer fan-made stuff, and then one of those is the shotguns. And then there's a way to get to the shotgun page, which I just bookmark. But I wish there was a way when you arrive at the Fairfield Project, just click a button like, let me see the shotgun scenarios. And there's not. It's a bummer.
We'll hunt it down for you.
We will. I dropped the next one in. You want me to cover that?
Please.
We've talked a couple of times about different, like, sort of documentary-style shows that we have seen in different places. And I ran across one, and I've watched, I think, three episodes so far, and it's actually pretty good. And this one is called Spycraft, and it's on Netflix, and it focuses on the technology of the tradecraft. So there's a lot of, like, the use of satellites, the use of listening devices throughout the, you know, really from the Cold War on. And remember when I went on about recently about the typewriter, the IBM typewriter sort of scam that the Russians had running in Russia?
Yes.
They covered that in the series. So I'm liking it so far. Some of the Netflix stuff is a little lightweight or a little, I don't know. They don't give it much research, I think. This is not like that. These are pretty cool episodes. I think it's a limited series. I think there's only one season. It's like maybe 8 or 10 episodes, something like that. So I'm three in. It's so far, it seems like it's worth watching. So for anybody who wants to get a little more on the tech side of things and how it's evolved through time, it's a pretty cool series. It's good.
I don't know if I started that one. I don't think I got too far. Is it the one where it talks about like the one vault with every weapon made?
I haven't gotten to that yet.
Maybe it's either part of the series or I'm thinking of a different one. You just haven't gotten to it. I don't know. But
now I'm trying to remember. The episodes I've seen involve sort of surveillance as a thing. So it goes all the way from, like, you know, the parabolic microphones and the, you know, the Russians. Oh, man, it's you know what? It's worth watching. When the Russians built a new building for the new U.S. embassy in Moscow, they wired every freaking room with, like, and it's really cool. And of course, the CIA does the same thing for Russian embassies and whatnot. But they get into really cool detail about, like, the construction of the buildings and what the opposing force was doing because they knew what had been wired. So it's really kind of like there's lots of tradecraft in it. And so that's one episode. There's another episode that's pretty great that's around sex and espionage and basically the whole honeypot, honey trap sort of angle. And how, you know, how that goes back millennia, basically.
And there's a rash of them in the 80s, though. They were seducing Marines, I remember.
And more recently than that, there's these Russian, what are they called? Illegals. So they're not like part of the embassy. They're not a foreign national. They are in the foreign country, but they still have connections back to the Russian security services now. These are pretty cool episodes. They get into a lot of that. Hmm. They're pretty good.
I'll have to revisit or visit, I guess, depending
yeah.
on if.
Yeah,
if
I've been impressed so far. It's been good.
Very cool. I'll have to put it on the to watch list for sure. All right, let's get into encrypted comms.
Sir, we have an incoming encrypted transmission.
Okay, should we start with the written word or should we just start with the audio?
Surprise me.
Okay.
Sean and Harrigan, thanks for the mention in the Go Bag episode on Agent Provocateur and the live stream on the RPG Sean channel afterward in regard to the notion of premature imagination and any premature narration which comes afterward. Unlike a rules or adjudication error which negatively impacts fun, this is a potential issue which arises as a quality of how we play, and as such is it's something that only matters when it matters. I think that's very true, but it matters a lot. In other words, there are some folks for whom this will never be an issue, and maybe they find it difficult to care, but they're likely to play with some folks for whom it's a really fun, draining, big deal, ranging from just making any action encounter annoying to taking them right out of the reason why they want to play at all. It's a simple but subtle thing that can easily go unrecognized. And as our own discussions in Sean's live stream have shown, can be hard to describe. So for me, when how we play decreases the satisfaction of the people in the group that we're playing with, I find that's a legitimate problem that I, as a member of that group, should try and understand and care about, even if it's a small thing or a preference thing or tied to things that are less tangible than mistakes with the rules. So, in the case of premature imagination, the result of something which should be resolved by the system or the ruling of the game master is instead simply assumed or declared by one or more players, and play continues as if the use of the system or the ruling of the GM had already been done. Unless someone exerts themselves or interrupts to address and undo it. So it has that social aspect to it. It's an assumption of an outcome before any result or qualities have actually been determined in play, in the way that the group expects them to be determined. So this error starts with prematurely imagining that outcome as having been established. One of the common examples that's easy to start with is, I blow his head off rather than I shoot at him. So it can become the group's problem when that premature imagination then builds into a description that we all hear, that assumption takes hold. There's lots of excitement of, I blow his head off, but of course we know that the dice decide whether or not that actually happened. So depending on who it bothers, you have annoyance at poor impulse control or the risk of retcons or the realization that there's now going to be a long out-of-character conversation to explain the system and the procedure again and blah, blah, blah. Or there will simply be disappointment when the system or the GM interjects with an opposing outcome. Like, there's no upside when it's a problem. One of the more common reactions to this is when the player prematurely imagines success for themselves, especially in a heated moment with high stakes, and then must face the dice or deal with the actual framing of that conflict. But almost as common is where reasonable action is imagined, but as a completed string, regardless of the challenges for each step. And this is really common in spy games, such as, I grab the MacGuffin off the table, draw my Walther PPK, put it between my teeth, grab the rope, and leap out the window. Like, wow, what a cool moment! Until you start thinking of, well, there's the initiative order, there's the number of actions you can take, there's other characters in the room, each with their own actions, the rolls for dodging, people trying to stop you from getting to the MacGuffin, people from stopping you to getting to the window, and, of course, the roll to safely swing out that window, and so on and so forth. It's an era of enthusiasm, of jumping the gun, of ignoring the culture and style of play, and setting yourself up for disappointment. And it can kill any special atmospheres that you might like to go for, like horror or high action. And so it strikes me that it has some value to keep in mind. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Thanks, Anthony. That's Anthony Ruinslinger. If you listen to him, Casting Shadows is his podcast. He's joined me on the chat room on my live Saturday morning shows, and I've been on his show as well. But he wanted to clear that up after we mentioned it in a prior episode about premature imagination. And I even brought it up on a live stream as part of it, as a topic. It's an interesting thing because I see what he's talking about. I mean, I've did it in the Bond thing. Like, this is what I'm going to do. And I've gone and gone and gone. And Harrigan's like, well, hold on a second. Let's first, you know, you got these goons. Tackle the goons, etc. But
are we going to hear some of this when we do the vignette?
I think we will. I think we could pick out certain things. You know, part of me is like, how much is the game get in the way? If you are really going to run the game, like my buddy Jeff is that guy. I'm going to reach over, grab this, swing across, you know, cap him in the knee, slide across the floor before the door shuts down, yada, yada, yada. And then I'm the, hold on, time out. Let's determine initiative first, Jeff, to Anthony's point. But at some times, I don't know if that's a good thing to, well, hold on, time out. I mean, yes, we got to roll the initiative, play by the rules, but I don't know. It's also dependent upon what game you're playing and how that is facilitated, I guess. I don't know.
I'm trying to remember the conversation we had on your Saturday stream that Anthony's talking about, because we did, you dedicated kind of a whole hour to it, right? This was like 2 weeks ago. I'm trying to remember some of the specific takeaways. I can go look at it maybe. I don't know. One of the reasons why I think Anthony has called in and been a little more explicit with what he's talking about is that, you know, we struggled with some offhand comments that were made. I think Peter was the one who brought it up originally. A couple weeks ago, we looked at some text that Ruinslinger had put on his blog a while ago and kind of talked through. You know, I think I probably flippantly said something like, I don't really see it as much of an issue in my own games kind of thing, which is probably one of the reasons why he's talking about it here, that, you know, it is for some people, it isn't for others. It seems so system and group dependent.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would ever establish some like rules of the road or best practice without it being decided by the group for the game, knowing whether or not you had to roll initiative, what the action economy looks like, how cinematic is it versus how little agency do you have if it's a horror game? Like all those things matter deeply. I certainly see what you're talking about, Anthony, that like if somebody is like having a bad time at the table because of this kind of thing going on, I absolutely think it should be addressed, raised, discussed, and fixed, right? Like figure out how to, with the system you're playing, how can we avoid that? I do think what you're saying about Jeff, Sean, like don't do that. Don't run your actions steamroller over the scene and everybody else who's present. In fact, you know where this can be really bad is in play-by-post games, where you're kind of all posting in a vacuum. The scene has been set by the GM. Along comes somebody. I've seen this to horrific end in Power by the Apocalypse games, because you know there's lots of agency, and there's no initiative, so if one person's successful, the moves can kind of keep flowing. So I've seen people sort of seize the spotlight and just keep on going, right? To the detriment of locking everybody else out of the action. Now, that means the GM's not doing their job. The MC is not doing their job of moving the spotlight around and whatnot, but it does happen. And that's related to this, I think, which is this whole idea of, I can picture these things. There's no rules for them, for example. Like in, you know, Power by the Apocalypse games and many games, there's no rules to like cross the table and pick the thing up off the table. Unless somebody is competing with you, or the building's falling down or whatever, right? And that's where you get into some mechanics around making a save or some sort of opposed role or whatever, right? I do think it's on the comes back to being on the GM to prevent those things from happening in a way that is harming somebody's play experience kind of thing, right? You also might get to a point where the way that a certain game plays out is not going to be to somebody's liking, like the way the mechanics support the hold up. We have to do this, this, and this first mechanically. Like I think I mentioned before, a couple of times, Fate has the, when you roll the dice, there's a negotiation, right? There's a, ooh, look at my result. Let me see what else I can do. I'll spend a fate point. I'll invoke this aspect. Might be a room aspect, might be an aspect on the villain, might be an aspect on your character, but you're paying a fate point and you're increasing your die roll by two. You're doing that in the middle of your narration. So the narration starts with, well, I draw my ray gun and I fire at him. And the way that Fate describes it is with an ellipsis, with a dot, dot, dot. I fire my gun, you roll the dice, you negotiate the outcome, and when you end up with the, you know, the success, you then say, or GM or you then say, you get him right in the chest, he's disintegrated kind of thing. But you don't do that last bit, the shot in the head, until you've resolved it with the dice. There are other mechanics. Sean, we're playing right now, Deathmatch Island and the Aegon games. You roll the dice first, and then you have to piece together what does it mean. So you don't prematurely narrate anything.
Nothing, yeah.
You know what? You almost adopt a old school D&D style of declare your action before we get into the phases of how it's going to run. Like, what are you doing? I plan to move and attack. I plan to fire my bow twice at the back line of their archers. Deathmatch Island and Aegon pick up from that a little bit. Like, what are you trying to do overall here? Okay, cool. Build your dice pool, roll your dice, now narrate. And you know, the games go. They slew back and forth from that very hard line, like narrate everything afterwards, to what Anthony's talking about and what you're saying that Jeff does, where people narrate too much. I still struggle with encapsulating it in a meaningful way that I could talk about it with my group. It's more like when you know it when you see it and address it when you see it. But having my blather about all that, anything else occur to you that we need to address here?
No, I think it's going to be dependent upon the table and the situation. I get some. Sometimes I think the enthusiasm gets to a point where it can roll into that and the GM can inject. And I think it's part of role-playing games.
Yeah. I mean, it's related as well to the whole deflation that can come from it's a critical moment.
Yeah.
There's a maybe not even a long description, but an awesome description of how meaningful this is to the character, right? Like, this is what I've been waiting for the whole freaking campaign for. And they fumble, they roll a 3, they roll a 99, whatever, right? It's just a wet fart moment. I see that as more deflating and more often, especially in D20 and percentile games, and frankly, in YZE games too, where the die pool can turn on you, right? And that's where all these games that lack meta currency, you don't have nothing to say about it.
Right.
You just look dumb now. Now, I do think this is where it's down to the table. I'm going to retract my last statement. It's down to the table and the GM to make sure you're not looking dumb unless it's a comedic game. There's a reason why the character failed in this moment, but you can make it so that it fits with the narrative and even with the character's like motivations and drive, like what led them to this moment. The failure can still be meaningful. And in many cases, it can actually still be success if you want it to be, and the GM can extract a heinous toll on the character to be successful. That topic, Sean, is what I'm going to return to in my own Harrigan's Hearth. I mentioned it on your stream recently, actually, this whole idea of pulling some story games, some Fate and Power by the Apocalypse approaches out of those games, because I don't like those games as much as I like trad games these days. I like a more straight ahead experience that appeals to more people, but I like being able to drop in that methodology for what does failure mean when you had this moment? What can you do with it? I think you can pull out some really cool mechanics and approaches from the more story game side of the industry and drop them on top of Call of Cthulhu, on top of D&D, on top of all those games, and get some really cool outcomes. Hmm. I'm going to write that up.
Looking forward to it.
Cool. All right. What else do we got in the mailbag?
Got one more audio, if you will.
All right.
Hey, fellas, it's Laramie. First time calling in, so I thought I'd hit a couple quick notes. While I'm not the world's biggest espionage gaming fan, as you guys have met me, I'm roughly as covert as James Bond driving a tank through Main Street. However, a couple of quick notes. One, regarding notes at a con game, I'm also a fan of pulling people away from the table. I had a game 2-3 years ago at Game Hole, and I don't remember who I was there. Off the top of my head, I want to say Victor, Shannon, a couple of the fellas. No, just pull people away from the table, and half of them were decoys. It was me pulling somebody off the table going, hey, we're just doing this so people think we're talking. So let's talk for a minute, and we're not going to do anything. We're just going to look at each other. And you good? Okay, let's go back to the table. That works great. And you can do that, you know, I kind of did that in my home game. My Harrigan's been in my basement. There's a room adjacent to where my gaming table is. And that's, hey, let's go grab a beer, because that's where the keg fridge is. So back to this last episode, now in my VTE game, we have a separate channel that we can go over to that's called the keg fridge. And that's just a private channel for me and one of the players to go talk in. And it works out great. You're talking about specificity of weapons. I'm getting into Weird Frontiers a little bit, and the table I will be using is one half of a page for all firearms. If you're Harrigan, there's also a 20-page appendix that gets into all the nuances of all the firearms that I do not care about. But Harrigan, buddy, it's there for you, and I'm happy for you. And last but not least, I would like to also point out what you guys were discussing. Harrigan trying to deduce where people are from. If you're going to discuss St. John's, I recommend you go out and look at the QMJHL's fantastic St. John's Sea Dogs logo. It is a fantastic sweater. It's a beauty. And we'll see you guys next time. Cheers.
Thank you, Laramie. Man, that guy. So Sean and I are both smiling here. We both know Laramie personally. In fact, I wouldn't know Laramie without you, Sean, without your former podcast and the community and all that sort of stuff. And Laramie, I'll out him a little bit. He lives in Iowa, and I have business in Iowa from time to time. So three times a year, I try to swing by where he lives, and we get a beer, we get breakfast, something like that. He works in late shifts, so he's not always doesn't always have the easiest schedule. But sometimes we'll hook up when I'm going back to the airport, and we'll shoot the bull for a while. He's a great guy. Thank you, Laramie, for the gun nut stuff. I have that game on my shelf behind me, I think. So I should go dig in. Old West games can have some of the greatest gun tables of all, quite frankly. It's good stuff. I also will mention Sean. He threw out there at the end the whole St. John's thing and the Sea Dogs or whatever. Like you're gonna have an audience of about two people that understand what he's talking about. That is the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League in Canada. The Canadian system is very different from the U.S. system in terms of where the hockey players, how they're brought up, how they, you know, what their opportunities are. It's nowhere near as much of a collegiate system. It's much more of a junior hockey kind of thing. All across the country, there's these different leagues that young men play in before they go to the NHL or try to get to the NHL kind of thing. It's an on-ramp to the AHL and then the NHL and that kind of thing. So way to bring in some really esoteric stuff, Laramie. Love that. What do you think, Sean, of his pulling people away from the table without needing to?
I mean, I think it's good. I'll probably end up having to do that when I run my in-person espionage Cold War game. I may bring in details, though, like filler details that are maybe not important. Like, they're not like, hey, this is now you got to start scheming, or this is kind of what you realize. But still giving them info to think that there is still a purpose in getting them off the table. Although I have had game masters do that. Like, okay, we're just going to stand here and talk for a second to make it look like we're talking. And then I want you to go back and just laugh. I mean, there's something to be said about that, but sometimes you could give the player something confusing. Like, okay, this is what happens. My fear is that whatever, if I did come up with something, I don't want them to internalize it too much if it's really irrelevant. But it does help with the chemistry of the table, I think, when you, especially with this covert action game, it's going to be Cold War specifically. It's going to be quite a nuance in how that rolls.
Yeah, it strikes me as, again, something where the kind of the vibe of the table and the game you're playing matters a lot. Like, I can easily see if you're playing some sort of, you know, if there's a PvP element, some sort of player versus player or competitive element, you'll want to stir the pot, right? If you're playing Paranoia, if you're playing the cinematic version of Alien, where people have these agendas that change throughout the course of the game, pulling them aside, even if you don't have anything meaningful to say, will make people suspicious and just kind of is good. You know, but there's other games where it's just, I don't see it being a thing. You know, just there's no need to do it. I would also say that I think there is an extended gang of people he plays with pretty consistently. So they know each other pretty well. They're a gaming group that's going to goes way back kind of thing. So there's probably a lot of like humor and a lot of just, you know, camaraderie in those moments, as opposed to doing this with a bunch of strangers where you're like, hey, I just wanted to pull you aside and look at you awkwardly for a bit. Okay, now we're good. Let's go back. Right. They're going to be like, you're a freak. what is with you?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Laramie. Not really the first time you've called, but, you know, we'll let that slide.
Right.
For those that know, they know.
They know. We've brought it up here. Dirty bugger.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good, good.
We did it after Game Hole Con. I think we brought it up in the beginning where I was outing him as Mud Skipper.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. You want to tackle Dan's first one?
Yeah. Let me do Dan's. So Dan, also known as Dependable Skeleton, by the way, if you're on various social medias, I'm not sure how widely he uses that, but Dan says, just listened to your podcast on teasers and cold opens, so just recently, and I wanted to give you my experiences. I ran a James Bond 007 campaign off and on during the 90s and eventually came up with this teaser mechanic. Players got to choose who was the hero character of the teaser, who used his PC for the session. So the hero who became the PC, okay. All others, I'm with you. There's only one of the PCs was in the teaser. All others got to run the villains, thugs, bystander, NPCs. Hero points were earned as normal for the hero, but the villain characters got to earn hero points for their PCs, and they would get to use those later in the adventure. One additional mechanic was that the players running the villains could only earn hero points at ease factor 2 or below. I started at 1, but no one would try at that level. This had two reasons. One, they would fail much more spectacularly than otherwise, which plays into the Bond cinematic narrative. Two, they'd get used to trying things that they perceived to be harder or downright impossible without penalty. It's the villains and the thugs dying, not their PCs. So you see what he's angling for here is he's getting them to try some higher risk stuff because they're not risking their own PCs, right? Kind of cool. Definitely looking forward to Sean's cheat sheet on the subject. Dan Warby. Thank you, Dan. We always appreciate, you've been, I think, a consistent listener and writer in of good stuff that we can use. And I think we got one more coming up from you here. But you know what? I think we should maybe do Mirko's next, because Mirko, Sean, it is related to this. It's all about these cold openers and teasers. And I think the vibe, I think, or the takeaway I think people should have is that on top of the things that Sean and I covered a couple of weeks ago when we talked about them, there's other things you can layer on here that are really neat, like what Dan's talking about here, where you have a rotating spotlight for who the PC is in the teaser, but he built in mechanics that everyone else benefits from. Similar to what I was saying before, but it might be like a whole different team that ends up getting like TPK'd, aced, so you get to see how difficult the villain is kind of thing. This is just a different slant on that. Let's read Mirko's and then we'll stitch them together.
Cool. All right, Mirko, a.k.a. Digital Hobbit, writes, listening to the latest episode right now, regarding cold opens, the GM of the Outgun game I played at Game Hole Con did this really well, but with a slight twist. We started in media res with a snowmobile chase. No idea why we were there or who the opponents were, but we were in the middle of trying to escape from a bunch of enemies, also on snowmobiles. After that scene, we flashed back. Wait a minute. Why not motorcycles? That's all I'm asking. I continue.
Because snow.
Didn't stop because for my snow. Eyes only.
For your eyes only?
For your eyes only. Sorry. James Bond. Anyways. After that scene, we flashed back to 2 days earlier and played out the scenes leading up to that chase, including the start of the mission. Once we caught up to the present, we picked up where we had left off, including some grit we had lost during the opening. It worked great. Quickly got us into the action, gave new players a quick taste of the mechanics, and established the cinematic vibe for the adventure. I may borrow this approach in the future.
Love it. What do you think?
I like it. he took it in stride. I don't know if everybody else would be like, why are we here? What is going on? I don't understand. Like, you had to put a little faith in the game master that it's all going to come together. Otherwise, people would be like, I don't like how this started. Right? Like,
don't play with those people, maybe?
Right, it's a con game. They signed up, right? I didn't sign up for this.
I think it fits the genre, is what I would say to that.
For Outgunned,
Because,
sure.
Outgunned is like action-adventure. Not quite, maybe a little more on the action side of our covert action stuff. But certainly, these kinds of cold, you know, in the middle of things, in medias res moments are, man, they're very common in this genre. Very common. You know, even to the point where you're trying to, if you're watching a movie or something, you're trying to figure out, like, when, what, because it's not always obvious, when was this? Is that in the past? Has that not happened yet? And then, you know, the penny drops. You're like, oh, I get it now. Either because they've established a timeline, or you just, you know, it all fits together in some unique way. You're like, you can kind of start to put two and two together.
So here's my only caveat to that opening. When you do the, hey, here's where we are. We're going to start here. Then we're going to go backwards in time to start with the brief and then move forward to eventually hit that point. I'm not going to die.
Yep. I was about to talk about that.
Oh, sorry.
You've pulled the cap off what I think is potentially a problem with any of these flashbacky things where you don't make it.
Right? I proposed that to you. We were going to run Delta Green. And I said, after Impossible Landscapes or during that era, I said, if you want to play that old character, you're welcome to do that. And you're like, but this is running in the past. And I'm like, well,
I said, no,
yes. And you were like, no. I said, okay. Because of that.
That's
reason.
A little different, yeah. But yes.
But it's the same premise. Like, well, my character ended in 2015 and now you're allowing me to play a character in the year 2000.
Yeah. So what Sean's talking about with my Impossible Landscape character, there's a scene in the 90s. Then there's a scene in the 2010s or something. It kind of becomes modernish day, right?
Yes.
And you know, the character clearly survives through that, through all the trials and tribulations, and has a fate, has an ending at the end of the, as far as we got in that game, which was not the ending. We flamed out a little bit. You know, and then Sean said, I'm going to run a different game. Do you want to play that character again? We're back in the 90s. And to me, playing a whole like opera felt like too much to force in case something dramatic happened to the character that I wouldn't have been referencing in the earlier game we played in the future, blah, blah, blah. So here's the difference, I think, Sean. What you were suggesting was an entire adventure in a very deadly game that can kill your character or make them insane, like, easily. Outgunned, we're in the situation that Mirko's talking about. We're talking about running one or two scenes that you have to survive in a game where you have all kinds of meta currencies that will allow you to keep going, and has a fail forward mechanic and all sorts of stuff. So I think though that's the difference I would paint there. I still think it can be a little funky. Like what did you say about the grit that you lost in the first scene? Like, did you no longer have grit, or did that lack of grit return maybe when you caught up in the timeline?
Once we caught up to the present, we picked up where we had left off, including some grit we had lost during the opening. Yeah.
There you go. So if you lose some grit during the opening, when they played that second scene, which was the first scene in the timeline, you have perfect grit. You haven't taken any damage or anything, right? Okay. Interesting. I mean, it's still, there's a tiny bit of jank in there where, you know, maybe you shouldn't have been able to make one roll because you would have rolled into that scene not in perfect shape or whatever. But in terms of like a high, it's not what the game's for. And a high flying action simulating a movie, it works, I think, perfectly well. I do think the grittier games have to be careful. You have to be careful about that. Never going to go back in time. And there's this presumption that you'll make it and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Agreed. Thanks, Mirko and Dan, for those two things. Write-ins.
Yeah.
I pulled Mirko's off the Discord, so he probably isn't even aware we're talking about it.
It's not even really a write-in. It's just, he was musing idly.
Waxing poetic. Sorry. Yes.
Yes. Sorry, Mirko. But the point is, you can take those cold opens, those teasers in many directions, including in the past, different characters. You're playing the villains. You're playing some scene at the end of the movie, which you'll reveal later is important. There's all sorts of ways you can go with it. Pretty cool stuff.
The last one is Spez Baby. You want
to
read
it? Want me to do that?
It's up to you. Sure.
So this is from Spez Baby, better known as Peter. Hiya, Baggers. Very interesting episode on Agent Provocateur. I was intrigued because I like T2K, Twilight 2000, and I'm currently running a Tales of the Old West game. That's a third-party YZE Old West game. I was disappointed to hear that the game falls down on organization and editing. Hate to say, but you might have convinced me out of buying it. I kind of hate to hear that because I think the PDF's worth it. I don't know if I would get the hardcover. What do you think, Sean?
I mean, I don't know. To me, I've probably picked up worse. Like, I've probably picked up good formatted books, and then the game sucks.
No question.
Right? So
I think there's a good game in Agent Provocateur, and it suffers from its editing, and it's – I do want to play it, and that way we can kind of verify this whole, like, is the meta currency enough to prevent the YZE system from T-boning you feeling like you're a high-powered agent or not? I don't think we don't have the proof in the pudding yet on that. But I hate to hear that someone's, like, going to, you know, just – shrug it off and ignore it. But hey.
Yeah. I mean, it's usually the opposite where we're talking about great games all the time and people are like, oh, I got to go buy another game. Thanks a lot, Sean. You're breaking my wallet. You know, that's,
fair enough. If you only want to collect perfect games, it's not a perfect game. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it's I don't think it's that bad.
I don't regret buying it in the hardcover.
No, I don't either.
Damn it. You have two of them.
I got two copies because I was such a fan of it before I got into it.
Put it this way, I bought the hardcover off Amazon, so obviously no PDF, and then I later bought the PDF. I think it bears cruising.
I think if you're a YZE fan and you are a Covert Action fan, I think it is the game to buy.
100%. 100%. At least for now.
For now.
Okay, and he continues, in terms of previous careers, so he's still talking about Agent Provocateur. Do you think the game would be improved if they shifted those to similar roles used in Spycraft, such as Faceman, Soldier, etc.? Make it more about what the agent does now, not what they did before. I'm going to stop there and ask Sean that question because I think he knows Spycraft better than I do. I know what Peter's talking about here, though.
I do, too. And I do get – I don't understand the, like, well, I did this thing before I was doing the espionage thing. I was doing this before I was CIA guy. And it assumes, like, these guys are being recruited. I used to be a taxi driver. Let's pull you into the CIA, right? Where it's just, I'm a career agent person. I mean, I guess you could incorporate their background into it. Well, in high school, I drove cab, you know, right out of college, I drove cab while I was in college. So to his point, to me, it seems like this, their weird, traveler-esque character life path gen.
They are. And I think that is a very purposeful design decision.
It is. I don't think I'm a fan of that particular take, though I understand it.
So a more common take in the YZE, and Twilight 2000 is an example of this. Veyasin is an example of this. Tales from the Loop is an example. Usually you have an archetype, and it's who you are. It's your elemental role on the team,
yes.
Right? So people can quickly connect, put the Legos together, click, 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 click. Oh, I understand how all this works. You're the kid. You're the professional. You're the whatever. And this is not that. But I'll tell you one reason why I'm curious. Again, maybe we'll see it in play. One place that my players and I have struggled a little bit with Covert Ops. Covert Ops does this kind of cool thing where the skills are very, very large scale. So skills are like soldier, thief, technician, that kind of thing, right? Like they're broad categories. They're almost like professions or areas of wide areas of specialization. But the game gives you almost nothing on who were you before you became an agent. And because of the fact that it is not class-based, it is not archetype-based, but you have these wide-ranging skills that people overlap a little bit, there's a little bit of like, who am I in that game with the agents? I can tell there's a little bit of like, why would I have been recruited? What was my role before I became a member of this sector organization? And I think Agent Provocateur is trying to address that problem by doing the traveler type thing, and many games do it, right? Where you have some careers behind you. So you have a little bit of a path, and Peter's going to ask about this in a minute here, actually. There's a little bit of a path going on just from what you used to do kind of thing. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, I think this is where you like lean on that. So you get more experience, I think, in that game, if you leverage your career, is that right? Or your former career?
I don't recall. Maybe?
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
I don't remember if you get to use an extra die, if you get more XP, one or the other. Let me continue, because this next piece here, before he switches topics, it matters. So also, does Agent Provocateur offer a life path character generation system like many other YZE games? Maybe switching to something like that could beef up the agents. So the answer is no, correct, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, there isn't a definitive life path system similar to T2K, I would say, since he references it earlier.
Or Forbidden Lands, the addendum they published, remember? The booklet,
correct,
that they sent with it?
Yes.
Yeah, there is not a life path system, full stop. And I think the former career is meant to be a lightweight version of that. So certainly you could try your approach, Peter, and say, I want the archetypes to be what you are today, and I want to use a little life path system to generate who you were coming into the agency kind of thing. It would work really well, as it does in many other YZE games. All right, I'll continue. Unrelated, I'm not sure Harrigan is right. Maybe I shouldn't continue. I'm not sure Harrigan is right about the OSR being responsible for player skill in social situations. It kind of ignores the long history of the reaction role plus charisma mod in many old school games. I'd lay the blame, and we'll explain what the blame is here in a minute. I'd lay the blame more squarely on LARP and storytelling games of the 90s for that theater kid affectation. Anyway, very enjoyable episode. So this is getting back to the whole, like, do you recall the exact conversation this was around?
You specifically said, I think this is attributed to old school games because it takes the player knowledge to trump the character knowledge. When we were talking about, like, my specific example is Jeff doing intimidation or persuading a suspect, if you will, that they're investigating. And Jeff has done that professionally, so he role plays it and it's really good. But my argument would be that's not who Jeff's character is.
Yes. Yes.
And you said that has to do, I think, with some of the OSR mantra, because it does come to player knowledge over character knowledge.
I think what I said is that now that those muddies are further watered, those waters are further muddied by the OSR approach.
Correct. Things,
which Peter's now saying, I'm not so sure it's that, right? I'm just trying to get in my head, my memory Swiss cheese, as you know, Sean.
Yes.
I do remember the conversation. I don't remember the genesis of it as to why we were talking about that sort of, like, do you roll or do you let the person just role play? And when do you make the decision? I think what we talked about at the time was these games have mechanics or they don't, including games like Swivers that purposefully say there are no mental or social stats in this game and we want you to role play it, full stop. I'm going to disagree here. I'm going to hold my ground with what Spez Baby is saying here. So he says, I'm not sure he's right about the OSR being responsible for player skill in social situation, ignores the long history of reaction roles. I'm not talking about reaction roles. I'm not talking about figuring out how the monsters view when the party monsters or NPCs, when the party comes in. And, you know, I mean, most of the OSR games will say, if there's not a reason for them to already have an attitude towards the players, the PCs, I should say, you can roll on this 2d6 table. It'll tell you aggressive, hostile, wary, friendly, whatever it is, right? That's just setting the table for where things kind of go from there. And the charisma modifier bit, man, you are well into like second edition and beyond before that matters at all in any kind of social interaction. Doesn't matter in original Dungeons and Dragons. Doesn't matter in BX. In BX, I suppose you could do some kind of weird roll under charisma thing, but while that's present, you don't see it leaned on very much. Usually the charisma modifier is used for how many followers you have and all that sort of stuff. Through AD&D, I try to convince somebody you don't make a charisma check in most of those old school games. And then when we're talking OSR, of course, I think by now I probably have mentioned this more than once, I believe OSR games represent this like idealized version of old school play, not the real old school play. Like the way we played in the 70s and 80s is quite different than an OSR game now. And in many cases, I like the OSR better because it's either injected some modern DNA into the mix or it has refined some of those older play methods, right? It's fine, sanded off some rough edges and that kind of thing. The part that I struggle with, though, is this whole, like, the LARP community, I don't think is all that big when you get right down to it compared to the role-playing community. And the storytelling games, I think he's talking about Vampire, isn't he? Mainly? Maybe Amber? The storytelling games of the 90s, Sean is making, I have no freaking clue, face at me right now.
Well, it could, and it could be.
Appreciate the backup, buddy.
Yeah. I'm here for you, man.
Yeah.
And that is the storytelling system specifically, right? Isn't that what?
I thought it was. World of Darkness thought it was. Yeah. Maybe Peter can tell us on the Discord or another write-in exactly what he means here.
The saga continues.
I am the worst person to address this because I played and have played exactly zero of those games, whether it's Changeling or Werewolf or Vampire or Potsticker or Bumble Bunny or whatever. Like, what I'm saying is there's many of them and I don't know what they are, right? Like, and those were not my style of games in the 90s. They remain not really my thing today. So I'm not a very good authority to speak on them. But when is that hell be back before, Sean?
I mean,
pretty much never.
Right.
So I did do a little sniffing around, and the Vampire games have very, very specific social mechanics where you're rolling dice to seduce, to intimidate, to influence, like very specific. They're dice, they're D10 dice pool things. So I don't know, Peter, you haven't convinced me. I guess what I was trying to get at is that in the modern age, the OSR games have introduced this whole angle of you should just play it out and be a smart player and try to not roll dice. You should try to resolve the situation in front of you through smart play. And that can include talking smartly to the NPCs, right? As opposed to rolling up and saying, I want to make a charisma check or I want to make a persuade check or whatever. The OSR ethos that some people have would, you know, like the Chris McDowell stuff from Into the Odd is this all day long, like have a conversation about it and see what flows out of that conversation, you know, and you only roll the dice when there's a real risk, when you're saving against something. Otherwise, the GM is doing almost an FKR style. Well, what would happen if you said that? This would happen logically. And they're using their experience and they're using their ability to kind of like network all of the possibilities together to create the pathway that you're going to go down. Oh, if you said this and you said that, you made them happy, but you're going to piss them off by saying that. And it just evolves without any dice but hitting the table. So maybe give us a bit more on what you're thinking around the LARP and storyteller side of things. People, again, you know, I think we all know this. People can take an approach they like from one game and they try to apply it everywhere. So I've seen people try to apply these like OSR don't roll the dice approaches in games that have very specific mechanics for resolving things where you're supposed to be rolling the dice. Play the game that's in front of you, man. That's my advice. So thanks for writing and calling, everyone. Sean and I are still getting the rhythm down about how often we're going to do these Q&A sessions. I think we both really enjoy them because it lets us get a little more interactive with people and a little deeper into some of the discussions that, you know, we kind of blow past when we're doing an episode where we have a main topic. We have a mission brief as well, where we know we got, you know, 45 minutes or more of content just around that. So we don't always give as long a response to some of the questions, but I think we can on these Q&A shows.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks everybody for writing in, and I agree with Harrigan. We may trim down the length of a normal episode when we're talking about encrypted comms and then save a few for these. Am I kicking things over on my side? Because sometimes we get into covert action, then we get into role-playing games. And then we get some of those role-playing games topics that we can apply to covert action. So it kind of blends a little bit. Like the cold opens are one thing, but getting into premature narration, that could be the whole RPG hobby as a whole, which can take a little bit more detail in addressing. So,
yeah, I would say this, if people have thoughts about how well the formats are working so far, let us know. Like if you either hate the Q&A shows or you want to see more of them and, you know, don't want us to address any of the listener feedback in the regular shows, we can do that. We can also nuke the Q&A shows if people hate them, and we can maybe break up the main briefing a little bit more kind of thing, Sean.
Yeah. I did a podcast a while ago. I did a survey and said, hey, what kind of parts do you like of the show? And kind of get some feedback that way. Might be something we throw out there as we determine what season 2 might look like in the format of show. Like, we don't know if you like our banter, kind of heavy on the front end. It might be a little bit more than you're used to in some other shows, and same with the write-ins and call-ins and things of that nature. So we've gotten feedback that the length of the show and the episodes are like 2 hours. Yeah, no problem. I just hit pause and then I come back, and I know other people, maybe not so much, but.
You know, I worry about our sample size with that. And I think, you know, we're going to have a slightly shorter show today, at least. But when we got into, I think, a couple of the game reviews, we started going a little longer, right? We broke Top Secret into a number of parts. I think we tried to cover James Bond and Agent Provocateur a little more all in one. I think Bond had two parts and Provocateur had just the one, but it made them very long episodes. Let's put it this way. The people that we know who listen to the show, who are either friends of ours or acquaintances or we know on Discord, most of them were like thumbs up, like no problem. But that's not everybody who listens. So if you do think, guys, this would be way better if it was under an hour, you know, if you could trim it down, let's hear that. Like, we'd like to get your feedback on that as well.
Please. So throw us a grenade at gobagpod.com or hit us up at 929-BIG-DICE and let us know what your thoughts are. Even if it's like 10 seconds, like, hey, I really like this part of the show. Or how you've covered X or Y, maybe not so much this, because the negative can also be constructive. Make it constructive, negative or positive.
It could be like, you know, just get rid of that Harrigan guy and you are good to go, Sean.
Get rid of Harrigan, get rid of Sean. Be a better show.
get two new hosts and a different topic. A different.
These things would be great without these two Yahoos.
Just have Sean do the audio engineering on two other people talking about something else. That might be the trick.
Audio quality is okay. Rest of it could get thrown to the wind.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Go Bag. I appreciate it. On behalf of my co-host Harrigan, I'm Sean. Thanks, and happy gaming. See you on the next one. Want more of Sean and Harrigan? You can find Sean at youtube.com/RPGSean, where he streams every Saturday at 8 a.m. Central Time. You can find more of Harrigan's RPG musings at harrigan'shearth.substack.com. Links in the show notes. This episode of Go Bag brought to you with help from the following field operatives, special agents, black ops directors, and friendlies: Joe Swick, Roger French, Mirko Froelich, Tony Sugarloaf Baker, Huscaro, Laramie Wall, Eileen Barnes, Hepta Lima, Aaron Relia, Wayne Peacock, Old School DM, Jeff Walken, Yorkis Rex, Eric Salzwedel, Phil McClory, Jason Hobbs, Michael O'Holland, Remy Bilodeau, Crystal Eggstad, Eric Avia, Vornak, Brian Kurtz, Chad Glayman, Jim Ingram, Orcus Dorcas, Chris Shore, Brian Rumble, Victor Wyatt, Kevin Keneally, Andy Hall, Jason Weitzel, Salt Hart, Kelly K. Ness, Tad Leckman, Nicholas Abruzzo, Matthew Catron, Curtis Takahashi, Angela Murray, Mr. White 20, Jason Connerly, Shannon Olson, Ryan West, Kristen McLean, Larry Hollis, Glenn Seal, Jake at Faded Quill Gaming, Tess Trekkie, Tim Jensen, Kelly Ness, Nubis, Christopher Lang, Crowlog, Peter Skanes, and 1D4 Con James. Thank you, agents. We appreciate it.